I want to welcome you to this session, number 263, titled A Warning to the Rising Generation, Allowing Religiosity to Reign Over Spirituality. And I'd like to remind everyone to turn off your cell phones or pagers or noisemakers. And our presenter this hour is Dr. Michael Farnworth, recently retired from teaching at Ricks College after 20-plus years. Michael had an article, The Heroine's Journey, published in the October 2007 issue of Sunstone. He is married to Cindy Halliday, and they are the parents of Braden and his wife Melinda, Cammie and her husband Nate, and Jeff, their youngest, who will be returning from serving in the New York Utica Mission this month. Our respondent is Bill Hansen. He graduated from BYU, cum laude, honors with distinction, and earned his Juris Doctorate from BYU Law School. Choosing a city he hoped to retire in someday, he opened a private general practice in Payson, Utah, and during the past 27 years, in addition to maintaining his law practice, Bill has served twice as Payson's Chamber of Commerce president, four times as junior jazz basketball coach, and once as bishop. He and his wife, Lisa, have published a primary song and are the parents of seven children. Michael.
First, thank you for coming. As an educator, and understanding education, the root word is to educe or bring out that which is already present. And so many times we think of education as pouring something into our head, learning something new. And as I go through the ideas and thoughts of this paper, I hope that you will be attentive to the inward kinds of thoughts, connections, ideas that come to you personally. Although this conference addresses spirituality, there may be some value in exploring the tendency to confuse it with religiosity, as I did growing up. What is the difference between the two? Can a person be religious and not spiritual? Spiritual and not religious? These have been intriguing issues for me to investigate. Have you ever had a similar experience of trying to be obedient to all that was asked of you, fulfilling church responsibilities, praying, reading your scriptures, keeping the commandments, and still having a sense of emptiness? A deadened, haunting void mocking all your best efforts? Although my religious role-playing was typical of our culture, I didn't know a better way. Regrettably, it tended to breed a judgmental, calculating personality that was more inspired by petty comparisons with others than anything else. Religiosity is the act of engaging in the prescribed meetings, roles, and rituals of an institution. It involves belonging to, believing in, and being obedient to the teachings of a church. Success in religiosity may give one rank and privilege in its hierarchy. Religiosity, as a function of the mind, starts to become problematic when it assumes a rigid, competitive, egocentric stance of always needing to be right. Spirituality, on the other hand, is an awakened, individuated consciousness to life's intangibles. Spirituality is a manifestation of wisdom, beauty, truth, loving relationships, meditative practices, and inner reflections on being. Spirituality is a detachment from the ego. It invites suffering that stirs the heart to a higher order of compassion. Spirituality is a labyrinth of difficult awakenings which can free the spirit from the imprisoning attachments of the dominant culture. The following ideas are shared in the hopes of changing aspects of our religiosity that contradict our spirituality. Although one can engage both, I propose the following ideas in hopes of alerting the rising generation to perspectives that some in the older generation remain asleep to. When religiosity reigns over spirituality, four unfortunate conditions prevail. Please consider them. Condition one, prideful performance reigning over meekness. Condition two, ego reigning over heart. Condition three, shadow projection reigning over penitent healing. Condition four, self-contempt reigning over self-compassion. Condition one, prideful performance reigning over meekness. One of the dangers of pride is the generation of self-righteousness which neutralizes the grace and mercy of Christ in our lives. I have sat through numerous church meetings where the power of Christ was hobbled by the conventional understanding of our after all we can do ego theology. We have been seduced by the illusion of our culture's grandiose but false belief that we can accomplish anything we set our mind to, a kind of whatever the human mind can conceive it can achieve syndrome. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity explains a difficult notion about challenging this type of pride. Quote, "If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud, and a biggish step too. At least nothing whatever can be done before it. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed." Close quote. I believe human beings and institutions suffer from conceit. The cultural myth of self-sufficiency easily extends into the self-righteousness which is frequently found in religiosity. These tendencies are important to explore because in attempting to establish our righteousness by virtue of ego willpower, it counts for nothing. The prophet Lehi taught us that by the law no flesh is justified. And the apostle Paul warns about having the law as a mistress, which acts as a replacement for being married to Christ. Martin Luther explains why romancing the law is dangerous. Quote, "Wherefore it is impossible that Christ and the law should dwell together in one heart. Either the law or Christ must give place." Close quote. When our hearts are captured by the affection of the law, there remains little room for the fondness of Christ's mercy and grace. Martin Luther, in his commentary on Galatians, tries to help us understand the spiritual dead end of self-righteous sufficiency. Quote, "As long as the opinion of righteousness remains in a man or woman, there abides also in him or her incomprehensible pride, presumption, security, hatred of God, contempt for his grace and mercy, ignorance of the promise and of Christ. The preaching of free remission of sins through Christ cannot enter into the heart of such a one, neither can he or she feel any taste of savor thereof, for that animate wall of the presumption of righteousness resists it." Close quote. The contempt for Christ's grace and mercy is manifested by an infatuation with the law and striving for perfection. Although the enthusiasm for self-righteous perfection may be understandable for a people socialized in homogenized conformity, it scares the bejeebers out of me to think of giving up my own self-willed efforts at salvation. But maybe that's exactly what Paul had in mind when he said, "For by grace ye are saved, through faith." In other words, and this is important, how much faith do I have in the grace of God to save me? I am sure many of us are more comfortable cloaked in the security of our own willpower to do what needs to be done. There is an enormous difference between controlling oneself using the discipline of ego pride and that of being spiritually begotten into a new creature and child of Christ. I sometimes get the feeling that we want to live our life in such a way as to negate the need of even having a Savior. The merciful plan of the great Creator is that Christ shall save us from the depths of the unavoidable ocean of sin. We are dead in the water. Law and justice have us within their grasps, and they are pulling us under. They demand our destruction, and we cannot escape them except through the love and mercy of our Savior. The lifeline that is thrown to us is a spiritual rebirth. Christ is holding the other end and will reel us to his bosom if we but take hold of the line. He will accomplish the work of spiritual salvation, not us. Too many of us have been seduced by the power of our own ego will discipline by continuing to deny God's gifts of spiritual power in our life. Hugh Nibley explains this unfortunate attitude regarding God's gifts. Quote, "People don't want them. No, not as gifts. They are proud and they don't want to accept a dole. Their hearts are really set on these things. They want to have them, but they want to earn them fair and square and to be beholding to no one for them. They want to say, 'This is mine because I earned it.' So we actually reject the gifts of God. As gifts, we despise them." Close quote. The implications are spiritually troubling, and herein lies the heart of the problem. Some of us think our own calculated efforts at religiosity will fare better than receiving the spiritual gifts of Christ's mercy and grace. In the Bible, the translated Greek word for perfect is telios, and it means to be whole, mature, a full age, finished, and complete in Christ. Instead of using this scriptural interpretation of perfection, we talk, instead of a perverse cultural notion, of the prideful ideal of not having any flaws, especially in comparison to others. This isn't perfection, but rather an unfortunate blunder of egotistical origins, and sadly leads to the kind of observations made by Mohandas Gandhi. Quote, "I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." Close quote. I don't think Christ will be proud of our version of religious self-righteousness either, since being meek and poor in spirit are antithetical to it. Condition 2, ego reigning over heart. The psychologist Carl Jung described the ego as the socially created facade of our idealized self. In other words, our ego is a societal phenomenon and creation. The ego represents the social, conscious thinking part of our brain with all of its defense mechanisms and intellectual powers. The ego is self-absorbed in its thinking and observations and is the command center for our conscious life. It sees itself on a pedestal and above the human fray. The ego is the resilient part of our personality where pride, vanity, arrogance, and grandiosity blossom and reside. The ego is a strong but false spectacle, which seemingly has a life of its own. The ego is that part of the personality which I would identify as the natural man or woman, and hence an enemy to God. Sogyal Rinpoche, a Buddhist teacher and author, addresses the counterfeit nature of ego. Quote, "The ego is our false and ignorantly assumed identity. So ego, then, is the absence of true knowledge of who we really are, together with its result, a doomed clutching on at all costs to a cobbled together and makeshift image of ourselves, and inevitably chameleon self that keeps changing and has to keep alive the fiction of its existence." Close quote. The bogus but resourceful nature of ego is legendary as the ego becomes its own deceiver. The ego-enlightened natural man and woman will ultimately be a failure in spiritual matters. Even though the gospel of Christ makes sense to us, and we are doctrinally intelligent enough to connect the dots, the intellectual fact still does little to open hearts to the transformation that comes from surrendering to Christ. As long as our ego is in charge, we will not yield our hearts to God. So here's the dilemma. The domain of the natural man and woman is the intellectual, conscious intention of ego, but unfortunately, it will not be our ego conviction that saves us. In his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, Marcus Borg, a New Testament scholar and author, explains that the word belief did not originally mean to cognitively accept a set of doctrinal teachings. The root meaning in Greek and Latin is to give one's heart to. This idea is more than a romantic notion concerning the heart. Neurocardiology is a new category of medical science dedicated to studying the intelligence of the heart and the impact it has upon the brain and the body. In fact, Armour and Ardell in the journal Neurocardiology, 1994, write, quote, "The heart is now recognized as a sensory organ and sophisticated information encoding and processing center with an extensive intrinsic nervous system capable of making functional decisions independent of the brain." Close quote. The heart produces an electromagnetic field 5,000 times greater than that generated by the brain, and functions at a completely different frequency. A person can intelligently consent and bear testimony to doctrine, but keep their heart in reserve and protected from the implications of their public declarations. Our idealized egos do it all the time, say one thing, yet do another. The ultimate goal of the gospel is to be spiritually begotten of Christ. That spiritual journey is of the heart, not the ego. The journey can occur when the adult ego, the journey can only occur when the adult ego is displaced by the loving belief of a child's heart, and that can only happen by and through the spiritual power of Christ. Unfortunately, it remains impossible for the adult ego to accomplish on its own. The absurdity of the adult ego surrendering its prominence over to a metaphorically begotten child was not missed on Christ, who said, quote, "Except you be converted, and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Close quote. When Christ visited the Nephites, he extended an important invitation to the survivors of the destruction. The invitation was that of coming unto him as a little child. They were told that if they didn't, they would not be able to receive the doctrine of the kingdom. Significantly, Christ gave this spiritual invitation to them not once, not twice, but three times. The begotten child represents the part of the personality that I believe the psychologist Carl Jung referred to as the divine self. It represents the sacred, holy places of the human heart and the true center of self. It is the human and divine energy fields unified into wholeness. The begotten child is the metaphorical part of the sacred self which needs to be exchanged for the culturally created adult ego. The heart needs to displace the ego as the control center of our lives, and that requires a spiritual journey. The author R.D. Lang does a credible job of describing this displacement of the ego. Quote, "True sanity entails in one way or another the disillusionment of the normal ego, that false self competently adjusted to our alienated social reality, and the emergence of the inner archetypal mediators of divine power, and through the death, a rebirth, and the eventual reestablishment of a new kind of ego functioning, the ego now being the servant of the divine, no longer its betrayer." Close quote. A past student shared this dream, which might illustrate some aspects of the ego. He was in a pleasant building, but one he did not recognize. Suddenly, he realized that he was in some kind of morgue. He was next to a nicely decorated room with a casket in it, and curious, he walked up to look inside. When he got closer, he saw himself lying in the casket, whereupon he took hold of his arm and shook himself, calling out his name in an attempt to awaken himself from the dead. He, as the corpse, opened up his eyes and angrily yelled out at himself, "Leave me alone!" Whereupon he awoke from the dream. As an interpretation, when confronted with any change of its paradigm, the ego metaphorically yells out, "Leave me alone." It will not surrender its prominence and will fight any challenge to its sovereignty. The ego, as an enemy to God, will never voluntarily submit control of its superior position in the human psyche. It is only by consenting to the ego's death and realignment that new life can spring forth through the power of redemption. Suffering the pains ego's transformation makes the resistance understandable, but not excusable. Condition 3. Shadow projection reigning over penitent healing. The shadow is part and parcel of our fallen nature, and as such is vital to our spiritual awakening to the opposition that we carry within us. The necessity of doing shadow work is essential to our spiritual life. Without shadow work, we remain lost in the labyrinth of self-righteous, pretentious behavior. The shadow is part of the personality construct described by Carl Jung and represents the underbelly or dark side of our human nature. A sort of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde split. The shadow is that part of ourselves we keep hidden from others in the hopes they won't suspect its presence in our personalities. However, the people closest to us are always aware of its presence. The shadow will not be ignored and creates untold harm and destruction when it is fragmented off from our conscious self. The following two stories illustrate some possible shadow dynamics. Once there was a man who was a janitor in the temple, cleaning it at night. He often worked alone and would sometimes get scared. It wouldn't be anything serious, just a little on edge at strange noises and such. One evening, while up on a ladder, he was cleaning some glass in a semi-darkened room when he thought he saw another person in the glass's reflection. He panicked. Frightened, he quickly turned around to see who was there and just about fell off the ladder in the process. As he composed himself, he realized that the image he saw in the glass was his own reflection. There are several possible metaphors to this story. The temple is symbolic of our own sacred inner places. The cleaning represents excursion into the corridors of the sanctuary to tidy up the day-to-day business of living. The anxiety suggests the dread of being alone in the darkened rooms of the heart, and the panic represents our fear of catching a mirrored glimpse of our hidden shadow self in those lonely places of the soul. Rachel Remen, in her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom, shares the story of her young childhood when she took the dark pieces of the jigsaw puzzle her family was working on and hid them under the sofa cushions because she didn't like the dark pieces because they reminded her of spiders. But the puzzle, just like our life, cannot be completed if pieces are being hidden. Projection is the defense mechanism labeled by Freud and articulated by Jesus when we see in others hidden aspects of ourselves which we push out of our awareness and onto others. Robert Johnson, a Jungian therapist and author, teaches us, quote, "Unless we do conscious work on it, the shadow is almost always projected. That is, it is neatly laid on someone else or something else so we do not have to take responsibility for it. Projection is always easier than assimilation," close quote. Projection places the blame on someone other than ourselves. We project our own threatening shadow material on others as a way of escaping personal responsibilities from our own issues. It is a very convenient, effective form of self-protection from the troubling characteristics which may haunt us. The psychological integration of the shadow, which we find so difficult to engage, is nothing more than having the courage to own our own sinful natures. Our ego is loath to take ownership because of the supposed humiliation it would spawn. The process of accepting our shadow is one of embracing our desperate need of redemption, despite the shame and fear of doing so. Carl Jung explains the difficult dilemma of ego that the ego has in confronting the shadow. Quote, "The shadow is a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality, for no one can become conscious of the shadow without considerable moral effort. To become conscious of it involves recognizing the dark aspects of the personality as present and real. This act is the essential condition for any kind of self-knowledge, and it therefore, as a rule, meets with considerable resistance," close quote. Interestingly, this resistance in confronting our shadow may be part of the perception that others sometimes have of us. Too often, as Mormons, we are seen as one-dimensional, vanilla-flavored personalities that appear superficially sweet. Unfortunately, our placating behaviors are sometimes seen more as public relation ploys than genuine human interactions. If we ignore the nature of our shadow, we court the spiritual misfortune of guileful hypocrisy. When the shadow is ignored, its potency grows. It becomes more difficult to keep under wraps. It is only by spiritually integrating and embracing the shadow energies and desires that the shadow powers can be diffused. By refusing to integrate the shadow, we remain dishonestly disconnected from ourselves. We came here to the earth to live, taste, and to know for ourselves the good from the evil. Living life honestly takes spiritual courage, the kind of courage that the author Florida Scott Maxwell described as living fierce with reality. And shadow healing is a necessity. The type of shadow healing that is required for spirituality is not the prescribed checklist of behaviors or steps that originate out of religiosity. It is rather the enlightened suffering that one's very best nature and efforts are woefully insufficient. This lifelong penitent healing is a difficult sacred work and encompasses a willingness to remain vulnerable to the reality of being lost but for Christ's redemption. Meredith B. Mitchell, a Jungian psychologist, captures the difficult nature of his own shadow work. Quote, "Working on the shadow is one of the hardest things I have ever done. It is a gut-wrenching activity every time I have done it. I felt as if I were being torn apart. Each step feels awful, and I urgently want to free myself from having to face my dark side by denying that the shadow element exists. I would much prefer to do something clean and comfortable. For what lurks in the darkness seems alien and hostile," close quote. The reason many of us can't confront our shadow is because it would require us to acknowledge that the darkness is inescapably within us. We cannot change our shadow nature with good behavior. When we have spent a lifetime pretending the darkness is not within us, it becomes an almost impossible spiritual confrontation to make. The oppositional nature of our mortal condition was determined by our first parents when they partook of the forbidden fruit and became as the gods, knowing good and evil. The metaphorical lesson of the garden was the knowledge of good and evil was ingested and became a part of us. The evil is inside, and there is no escape, no redemption except through Christ. In the movie, The Empire Strikes Back, Luke is training with Yoda when he is enticed to go down into a cave where he senses great evil. Luke takes his lightsaber, even though Yoda tells him he will have no need of it. In the dark underground cavern, he confronts Darth Vader and engages him in battle, which he eventually wins by severing Vader's head from his body. Lying upon the ground, Vader's mask dissolves to reveal Luke Skywalker's own face. Luke has just done battle with himself, but unfortunately, Luke did not trust the Force. He depended upon his own efforts by taking his lightsaber in with him because of his fears. Luke may have defeated himself in the symbolic confrontation, but the dark side of the Force remained in his heart. This is a well-known theme in mythological literature where the hero has to confront and engage his own dark side. It is a theme in our life too. And just like Luke, we cannot succeed in this confrontation by conquering the self. Our shadow side needs redeemed, not dominated. Accordingly, a physician of light has been made available who will heal the darkness within. Condition 4, self-contempt reigning over self-compassion. The pride we carry within ourselves originates by way of our fall, of our fallen idealized ego, and feeds our self-contempt. Naturally, this makes us feel undeserving of the grace and mercy of our Savior. To appreciate the profound destructive workings of this simple arrangement, I want to explore two pivotal ideas about pride that C.S. Lewis talks about in his book, Mere Christianity. The first idea is this: pride always means enmity. It is enmity. And the second idea is pride is the complete anti-state God of mind. Enmity means to have hatred, contempt, hostility, opposition towards God and others. Ezra Taft-Benson, in his Beware of Pride talk, addresses this enmity towards God and others, but additionally, we experience enmity toward ourself. The destructive phenomena of self-enmity begs further investigation. The general lack of self-worth and depression run rampant in our culture because of distorted notions of self-worth. Many of us assume a stance of prideful vanity to help us survive the onslaught of psychological violence this distortion brings to our young lives. But regrettably, the pride that once helped us stay alive can morph into something that can spiritually destroy us later on. It is common to the human condition to remain unaware of the pride we carry within us, as well as the enmity derived from it. Some of us cannot face what is inside us because of the shameful humiliation we know is lurking just beneath the surface of our seemingly normal lives. As educated people, we all know we're not supposed to hate ourselves, so we endeavor not to. Some of us attempt faking self-acceptance because we want to appear a certain way to self and others. We often use the popular self-improvement notions of a fallen culture while mingling them with the gospel of Christ to increase the perceived self-worth and esteem. Unfortunately, nothing could be more effective in preventing our coming into Christ. Self-esteem sponsoring techniques simply camouflage the real problem of prideful self-contempt and postpone the needed healing. In this condition, it remains impossible to come into Christ enveloped with pride and the subsequent enmity spawned from it. Enmity and godliness are foreign to one another, so if one is present, the other is absent, thus accounting for C.S. Lewis's complete anti-state God of mind. Psychiatrist and author Theodore Rubin explains in his book Compassion Self-Hate just how dangerous this enmity towards self is. And I'm going to substitute therapeutic, I'm going to substitute the word spiritual. Quote, self-hate is the strongest anti-spiritual agent in existence. Its potential for destructive possibility is almost limitless, close quote. If Theodore Rubin is right about the destructive potential of self-hate, then it could be the most important spiritual healing we could ever receive from God. I love the teaching of Christ that explains that a house divided against itself cannot stand. I understand this scripture to be a reference to the state of enmity within ourselves. We are the divided house which cannot stand. Oneness is a state of spiritual peace, but we cannot receive Christ's peace if we remain at war with ourselves. Curiously, if we perceive the self as an enemy, which seems common in our religious culture today, then we should follow Christ's teaching concerning our enemies, namely, to love them. The divided house metaphor teaches us we need to obtain some kind of harmony within ourselves by having our self-loathing healed. This may be a key in surrendering to Christ. The ability to compassionately embrace oneself is a gift from God, and we can seek after it. Only God's grace is powerful enough to quiet the pride and subsequent enmity that rages in the hearts of men and women who rely upon our own strength for salvation. Interestingly, the self-contempt and hatred we harbor within us becomes the fuel for our redemptive self-willed efforts. Think about how angry we sometimes get when we sin, make mistakes, or fall short of our goals and good intentions. Where do we think the anger and contempt come from? It comes from our self-enmity, our exaggerated self-righteous disappointment, and it is not a good or godly thing. One of the reasons we may resist self-acceptance is because it would neutralize the self-contempt and loathing unconsciously used as the fuel for the moral motivation of change in some of our lives. Unfortunately, many of us think we should be able to fix ourselves before Christ saves us, but this is impossible. This mistaken notion is rooted in our prideful enmity. We need to try a different paradigm, a paradigm of surrender and submission, rather than the paradigm of control and power. When we are a house divided, it keeps the only power in the universe that could heal us locked out. The first step of healing necessitates a tender, loving embrace of that which we consider sinful, wounded, repulsive, and dangerous, namely ourselves. This kind of kindness and gentleness toward the self can be a gift from God and is the fruit of the loving compassion of Christ. We can be transformed by His love, changed by His mercy, ennobled by His grace, and born of His Spirit into a new creature with a new heart. Truman Manson teaches us the blessing and power of Christ in our lives is simply, quote, the offer of forgiveness before we have changed, in order that we may change. That is the power of Christ, close quote. The act of surrendering is inviting God into our house because we desire a remodeling by a power not of ourselves. It is in the tender embrace of self in all its wounded darkness that God's best and highest manifestation of grace is found. The change many of us in life desire can paradoxically be brought about in surrendering our self-willed efforts to Christ and by grounding ourselves in suffering the humiliation and hurt of our lives. This is the spiritual path. Conclusion. Our egos may excel in religiosity, but will fail miserably in spiritual concerns. We put ourselves at great disadvantage neutralizing the grace of Christ by relying upon our own vain self-willed efforts at salvation. If we live under the dominance of our ego, living incoherently from our heart, out of sync, out of phase with our more profound true natures, then we will be plagued by the attributes of arrogance, pride, and grandiosity. This incoherent spiritual state will nurture our self-contempt, making our shadows even stronger. Fortunately, there is another path available to us, the pathway of heart. The first law of heaven is love. And the commandment to love God with all our heart, might, mind, and strength is followed by the commandment to love others as we love ourselves. The scriptures tell us that upon these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. These directives appear straightforward and comparatively simple. Nevertheless, they make up the challenging spiritual journey of the heart. Please reflect upon this observation made by my son Braden while serving his mission in the Philippines. Quote, I have been thinking of the people I come in contact with every day, especially those of a strong belief in another religion. I'm finally beginning to see, or at least I think I do, that their feelings, beliefs, and paradigms about Christ and their religion are just as strong and real as mine, and that my beliefs are no truer, in a sense, if I am not living as a loving and merciful person, that I could actually be more wrong and further from Christ than those of other sects. If I do not love, that the claim of love has actually the greatest claim of all. Close quote. Consider for a moment that the separation of the sheep and the goats at the judgment will not be on the basis of church membership, dogma, or performance. The separation will occur on the basis of the treatment of our fellow human beings who were hungry, thirsty, sick, naked, or in prison. Christ places himself in their position as being one and the same, and our treatment of him is reflected back to us in mirror-like fashion by our treatment of them. The way of truth is not found in the theology of a proud ego, but rather in the meek, loving relationship with self and others. Parker Palmer, a Quaker educator and author, reminds us of this important spiritual truth. Quote, "Jesus calls us to truth, but not in the form of creeds or theologies or worldviews. His call to truth is a call to community with him and with each other, with creation and its creator. We will find truth not in the fine points of our theologies or in our organizational allegiances, but in the quality of our relationships." Close quote. The tensions between religiosity and spirituality are many, but when all is said and done, much of religiosity can unfortunately be reduced down to an egocentric preoccupation with meeting the expectations of an organization. Spirituality, on the other hand, is of another inner dimension. It can invite an awakened, compassionate relationship with self, God, and others. In due course, religiosity or spirituality will reign over the other, and that eventual sovereignty will determine the nature of the life we live.
Can you do it in 15? Okay. Okay.
Michael Farnworth has presented a masterful discussion of religiosity and spirituality. And I would hope that all of you would get a tape of this session and listen to it over and over again. There was much more there than a person could grasp in merely a few minutes. But a couple of things have come to my mind as I thought about the terms and the ideas that he presented. One of the things that he brought up was the idea of self-deception and the play of self-deception as we try to encounter our shadow selves and the tension between religiosity and spirituality. Self-deception is a dilemma that can be described in the following terms to give you something additional to think of as you ponder that struggle. Assuming that there is self-deception, it implies that a person is both the deceiver and the deceived. If a person is a deceiver, then he knows that about which he is deceiving, and therefore he cannot be deceived. As you think about that dilemma, think about the ideas that were presented about how we hide the truth from our knowing selves. Michael talked about the heart versus the brain, about a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde. Those are really good analogies. The fervor, the anger, the angst that we have about religious performance can often be used to mask that which, on closer examination, we may already know. But in our desire to avoid, try to cover over from ourselves. But does our zeal in covering something over allow us to abdicate personal responsibility? Can we ever truly say, I do not know? Am I truly deceived? Or do I really have an internal beacon that, upon quiet listening, will tell me what is truth and what isn't truth? I had an opportunity to spend some days with a Benedictine monk by the name of David Stendel Rost. He taught me a number of things. One of the things had to do with a grateful heart. He talked to me about gratefulness and the heart being a way out of the dilemma, the three dilemmas that Michael has talked about, or four, in terms of, see if I can, the ego versus the heart, the shadow, self-contempt versus self-compassion, and I believe there was a fourth one. What was it?
Shadow projection
reigning over penitent healing. The term obedience comes from a term obadiari, or obadience, which means to listen intently. Rather than thinking of obedience as a performance of the will of another, if we think of obedience as an intent, firm listening, it opens up the gateway to the heart and to the love that Michael talked about as a healing of these great dichotomies. Turns out that the opposite of obedience or obedience, intent healing, is absurdus, which means to be deaf. You find that if you're stuck in this dilemma, and to use Kellyan psychology, as we view things in terms of what they are and what they're not. And so you have the tendency to, a person has a tendency to vacillate between what something is like and what something is not like, and what something is like and what something is not like. And as we try to wrestle with these, we form grids of constructs, what's called construct theory, to determine what something is like or more like or not like, and we try to form an evaluation, an evaluative process. As we're bouncing around, unless we are quiet and obedient, things can get magnificently absurd. Magnificently absurd. Our goal between religiosity and spirituality, it seems to me, is to arrive at an integrity of love, an integrity of gratefulness, and an integrity of personal involvement. What I mean by that is this. One day I decided to participate in a hypnotherapy session. I was regressed by a person who was a student of Michael Newton. I don't know if you've read any of his books. But Michael Newton's regression led me to think of the following things. I envisioned myself as a monk in about 1490 in a church on the borders of Germany and somewhere around Germany and France. As I contemplated the life that I had, I remember specifically retiring to a very monastic room, very simple, and allowing myself to contemplate what good that life had done. There were some things that were good about it, But the solitude and the emptiness of that particular lifestyle, even though I was pursuing spirituality and to a large degree a very rigid religiosity, left me feeling completely empty. As I envision myself later confronting those who would judge me in heaven, I remember being extremely angry. I received a strict lesson about that, but the idea was there that even in strict religious performance or in spiritual performance, in spirituality, there is still something missing. What is that something that's missing? As I discussed this with my wife Lisa, who's here, she suggested the following things. Can a person be spiritual without spiritual practices? Can a person develop spirituality without spiritual discipline? I suppose a person can have spiritual longings, can even spend time musing on spiritual topics, may even be able to articulate spiritual beliefs and how they differ from others. But is this spirituality? A person may be a discriminating connoisseur of music, may spend enough time listening to music to be able to articulate preferences, may have deep musical longings, but can a person be a musician without practicing, without the discipline that goes into it? Although a person may be a musician in isolation, what is the calling of a musician when music is rarely combined with others to create something larger than itself? David Stendhal Ross suggests the following. In the being of a giving and a taking, a gift and a recipient of that gift, it requires that there be another person. I think we all, as children, have experienced the idea of tickling our own arms or something like that. I guess there's a certain pleasure involved with that. But nothing like a parent or something tickling your back. Feels entirely different. If we try to give ourselves a gift and we receive our own gift, the joy of the spontaneous giving, the personality of that giving, is simply not there. We can never duplicate the interaction with other people. And so we find the following. Why would we go to church? Do we go to church merely to lift ourselves up? No, we go to church. Many people will tell us that we go to church for the purpose of sharing each other's burdens, comforting those that stand in need of comfort, and other things. Now, we know also in 3 Nephi 20:21 that we have been instructed by Christ that He has established His church among us so that we might enter into a covenant. It's important to have a covenant. It's important that that covenant be witnessed. So you have spiritual longings that lead you to religious practices. Religious practices lead you to the involvement of other people, being involved with them, being witnessed by them, and being shared by them. Giving gifts, exchanging gifts. All of the interaction of that allows us to become something that no other beings can become and allows us to become most godlike. And that is, as we experience the giving and receiving and we experience the different points of view that come from that, it seems to me that that is the gateway to empathy. And that empathy and love are, in fact, the forces that hold the dichotomy of spirituality, self-absorbed spirituality, or hollow religiosity in check, and that balance them out. I would like to close by saying that the ideas that have been presented here are marvelous, and we should examine them with regard to our own lives, not letting our egos smash them down, not letting ourselves not examine the darker side of what we might have a tendency to do. But I believe, as does Michael Farnworth, that love, gratefulness, personal involvement, and empathy are the surest way to balance those and lead us to Godhood. Thank you.
If any of you have questions, please come to the microphone so your question can be recorded.
I'm not sure what you mean by how Christ and the law can't coexist.
Yeah, that was a statement by Martin Luther, and my understanding of that is that it's kind of like where does your heart reside? This is probably a bad example. Can you love two women? It's a bad example here. Is your heart, you know, can you give your heart to more than one person? And that's what he is suggesting, is that the nature of the heart, the preeminence of one will reign over the other. And if law is your mistress, and that's where your heart is, and that's who you're trying to please, and always preoccupied and thinking about, okay, what do we need to do? That's completely different experience than being married emotionally, spiritually to Christ, being freed of worrying about the lawful kinds of things and just living your life in abundance. That was my take on it.
Can I just say one thing practically?
Have you want? Please.
There's a word called yada, knowledge, love. And what you discover is that by learning about things, by studying things, by understanding and listening to each other, you develop love. You can develop love out of nothing. The reason that that is important is, and Michael Farnworth is in marriage and family therapy, and it has a very practical application with regard to that, and that is, when we become legally attached and decide to beat each other up in our most intimate relationships with objective standards of what we should and shouldn't be, there is no room for the love of listening, the love that's involved with being Christ-like. And if you're involved with holding somebody to a specific set of rigid legalistic standards, it chases out the love. They really can't coexist. To listen to a person, to understand a person, to see where they're coming from, to learn to love their point of view and empathize is a much different process than amassing a set of legal standards and then beating somebody up as to whether they're righteous or not righteous with those standards.
Thanks for your comments today. I do appreciate those. I found the comments about the heart and its ability to function as a center of intellect or a center of decisions to be very interesting from the aspect of the beliefs of the ancient alchemists who believed that the heart was the seat of wisdom. And I see some interesting parallels there. Another thing that came to mind, and I'm starting to lose it now, is I think I have lost it. You want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, let me respond to that, and then maybe it'll come. I love the idea of the... In our modernistic society, we've taken the heart and basically made it a machine that pumps our blood, and that's all there is to it. I find it fascinating learning about how the heart is another organ that processes information. And a lot of the heart cells are very similar to the cells that we have up in our brain, and I had no idea about that. And I think it's fascinating that the scientific community now has an area of study specifically devoted to neurocardiology, the brain that is within our heart. And I find it also fascinating that one can be brain dead and still be alive, still function as far as just a vegetative state, but there's no such thing as being heart dead. I mean, when your heart goes, it's done. It's, you know, it's over.
And that did bring back the other question, which had to do with shadow. It's my understanding of shadow that shadow is the things that are in potential in our lives that are unmanifested. Oftentimes, difficult, dark, and destructive things, but oftentimes as well, positive things that we have shoved into the unconscious because we have neglected them in some ways. I wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yes, the idea of the shadow to me is one of the most fascinating things to study, because especially in the LDS community, trying to get people even to consider the fact that they have a dark side when they try so damn hard to be so good all the time. And it really provides a very, very interesting psychological fertile field of just exploration. I know in my own life and in the life of others. Because of the content of the paper, I was limited on what I could say about the shadow. But the shadow is made up of some wonderfully powerful things, good things, that we may think are bad, and we try to keep them under wraps. In my parenting class, I had the students list five wonderful things about themselves and five negative things about themselves. They could always come up with the five negative. Sometimes they struggle with the five positive. But then I said, who told you these were negative? Well, yeah. And who told you the positive stuff were really positives? And then I'd get some examples. Give me a negative, and I could always switch it around to be, you know, on a positive. And I, give me a positive now, and I could switch it around to be a negative, depending on where the emphasis was, where the consciousness was. And the beautiful thing about the shadow is that it does hold great potential. And I love the idea of perfection being complete and whole, and what happens when we hide parts of ourselves. We will never achieve a state of wholeness, a state of completeness, especially if we rely upon our own efforts, you know, trying to hide. But if we can surrender ourselves to a higher power, trust in that, and know that, okay, this is part of this, this is part of the story, this is part of the discovery, and not be afraid of it. There are great blessings to be had from that shadow energy, that shadow nature that we all carry around.
The title of your paper was A Warning to the Rising Generation. Just in your experience as a professor and a marriage and family therapist, is there a reason you chose to direct it towards the younger generation as opposed to is a parallel that you see a fit of it for us?
Only because of the title of the conference. That's why I did. I wrote it for... One of the concerns that Sunstone has is the grain of its members. You look around most of the conference, a lot of middle-aged, older people are here, not very many young people. And so it's like, why not? And I think it may have been an attempt by Sunstone to appeal to the younger audience, but I don't know if there are any more now than any other time. But that's why. Is it needed? I think it's needed for the older generation too. I think that there's a preoccupation with performance, perfectionism, mechanistic kinds of things that feed the ego. I find it fascinating that our theology seems to be an exaltation of ego concerns. You want to be, you know, you're going to be a god someday, a goddess. You'll have powers and dominions, principalities all over the place. It's like, man, that sounds pretty darn good. And I like the Eastern philosophies of the goal is to detach from ego. And I think it's, once again, sets up some interesting puzzles to be solved about how we go about this spiritual religious stuff.
Thank you for being here. We're going to end this session now. Just a reminder, the recording of this session and all the others shortly after they finish will be available in the lobby over there. So.